Good morning, it's 7:34, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter. We continue our discussion with journalist Matthew Polly, author of the new biography, Bruce Lee, A Life. It's been 45 years since the death of the actor and martial arts icon, who died on July 20th, 1973, at the age of 32, 1 month before the release of his signature American film, Enter the Dragon, released on August 19th, 1973. And what impact did Enter the Dragon have on his movie career?
Well, the bittersweet aspect of Enter the Dragon is that he died a month before it was released in the United States. He died at the age of 32 on July 20th, almost exactly 45 years ago. And Enter the Dragon was released in August 1973. And the movie itself completely transformed Bruce Lee. He was a little-known former TV actor in a series that had, you know, been canceled after a year. So not many people knew who Bruce Lee was in the West. And his fame was entirely posthumous. After Enter the Dragon was released, Bruce Lee became the most famous Asian in the world. And he launched a kung fu craze. Before Enter the Dragon, there were maybe 500 karate studios, kung fu studios in the United States. 20 years later, there are more than 20 million Americans alone who study martial arts. And so he not only changed cinema, but he also affected Western culture. And in many ways, I think of Bruce Lee as a kind of missionary figure who brought over an aspect of Asian culture and converted millions of Americans to it.
And can you talk about some of his styles in his movies? Like, one of the signature things that I think about when I think about Bruce Lee is him kind of thumbing his nose a little bit and the sounds that he would make when he would be fighting.
Yes. Yeah, so Bruce had some signature moves. One of them was the thumbing of the nose. And what's funny is the movie he made as a 10-year-old in 1950 called The Kid, he does the exact same move. So Bruce was doing that thumbing the nose move since he was a 10-year-old. The animal screeching, which is everyone associates with Bruce, I spent years trying to find anyone who could explain where that came from. And no one, not his wife, not his friends, not his colleagues, had any idea. So I think he just made that up for the movie. No one recalls him ever doing that before, but he made it up for the movie and it turned out to be really effective. So he kept it.
And you talked a little bit before about him smashing stereotypes. Can you talk a little bit more about the Asian stereotype prevalent in American depictions of Asians during that time?
Yeah, I think this is one of the underplayed aspects of American culture is that we just miss the degree of Asian stereotypes that are out there, particularly against Asian men. What happened, of course, in World War II was the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and most of the soldiers were sent to the Pacific. And this created a large, what they called anti-Oriental, that's the term they used at the time, sentiment. And what happened in Western cinema, and particularly in Hollywood cinema, is that Asian men became to be portrayed as physically weak and asexual, a kind of a lesser race in cinema. And so most of the portrayals were of Asians as houseboys or, you know, pigtailed, bow-headed workers who were too weak and sniveling to ever stand up for themselves. And Bruce hated this representation because he was a very pugnacious fighter. Nobody ever accused Bruce of bowing his head. If you gave him any trouble, he'd punch you in the face. And so he refused to play those kind of roles, and he wanted to break down that stereotype. And so by becoming a kung fu master and playing that on screen, he was able to portray the Asian male as a heroic and also powerful figure. And that's one of the reasons he spent so much time working on his musculature, on his physique, because he wanted to convey power through the visual medium of movies, through the musculature of his body. And so after Bruce Lee was done, one of the things that a lot of Asians say is that no one ever thought we were weak and sniveling after that. They all thought we were kung fu masters. And that was totally to the credit of Bruce Lee.
And what about his role as a leading man? As far as I know, he only had one romantic scene with a woman on screen.
That's right. And that's one of the stereotypes is that Asian men are asexual or gay or not sexually attractive. And you can see it in Enter the Dragon in the harem scene where the African-American actor picks out multiple prostitutes to be with that night. The white actor, John Saxon, picks out the white madam, just one. And then Bruce Lee has a chaste discussion and has no sex at all. So what's fascinating is in the movie that made him a star, it reinforces the stereotype of the Asian male as asexual or sexually inferior. And it's too bad that he didn't live longer for many reasons. But one of them is he was offered romantic leading roles after Enter the Dragon was about to become a hit. He was offered $1 million to play a part with Sophia Loren, which would have been a romantic lead role. And so Bruce never had a chance to break down that second stereotype of Asian males as somehow sexually inferior.
But in his own life, he was married at this time with,
I know where you're going.
With two children.
Yes. He was not sexually inferior in his own life.
Exactly. So can you talk a little bit about his family life and his wife and children?
Sure. So he met Linda Emery, who became Linda Lee, when she married him at the University of Washington. She was a freshman when he was a junior. She had seen him before because he'd given a lecture at her high school, and she thought he was attractive and interesting, and so she had joined his kung fu school. And she admits herself she was kind of gaga for him. And one day he asked her out, and they started dating, and then she got pregnant, so they got married. He dropped out of school and went to Oakland to open his school. And they had a son, Brandon, who became a well-known actor before his tragic death, and a daughter later, Shannon, who now runs the Bruce Lee estate. She also spent a period acting in Hollywood. So he had a family. And of course, he had, you'll probably ask me, he had other interests on the side as well.
But you talked a little bit, well, extensively in your book about Linda's family's objection to their marriage because of the interracial aspects. Can you touch on that?
Yes. So one of the things we forget about now is that interracial marriages in the 60s were like what gay marriages were 10 years ago. They were illegal in 17 states. And it wasn't until the 1967 Supreme Court ruling in Loving versus Virginia that it was outlawed. Anti-miscegenation laws were outlawed across the country. And so many families back then, there's still not some now, of course, but back then it was a much stronger prejudice against white people marrying anyone of a different race or ethnicity, particularly daughters. And so Linda Lee was Caucasian. She was Swedish, some sort of Swedish European, Northern European mix. And she had to keep her dating of Bruce Lee a secret from her mother. She told her mother she was going out with friends and then she would go meet up with Bruce. And Bruce didn't like this. He only agreed to it because Linda insisted. And then when she found out she was pregnant, they planned to elope because she knew her family would disapprove. But when they registered to get married on their own, it showed up in the newspaper and her mother found out about it. And they called a powwow of all of her relatives in order to talk her out of getting married to a Chinese guy. And even when they discovered she was pregnant, they still didn't want her to marry a Chinese guy, which I find amazing. And so finally, she was very determined. She loved Bruce very much, and she wanted to be his wife. And so she told her mother, even if you disown me, I'm still going to marry him. And so her mother backed down and as a bargain asked them to do it in a church. So they had a very quick church marriage before they left.
And what about Bruce's family? His feelings about an American white wife?
Well, that's what's, of course, interesting, because in America, we only think about prejudice going one direction. But of course, prejudice is everywhere. And Hong Kong Chinese didn't approve of their children marrying Caucasians. And so they weren't happy either when they found out that Bruce was marrying a white American girl. They thought he should marry a Chinese girl or a Eurasian girl, but not a white girl. And so it took Bruce several months to kind of convince them that this was a good idea. But even when she showed up, she got a kind of chilly welcome from the family. And they were a bit disapproving There's one anecdote I tell in the book where Bruce is bragging about what a great cook she is in order to try to convince his mother that he married a good woman. But actually, Linda didn't know how to cook. And so she gets stuck in a situation where she has to make spaghetti for 20 family members. And she burns the tomatoes and ruins the whole meal. And she says as the family was eating it, they were all thinking, poor Bruce, he marries this worthless woman. And so she had to face a chilly reception, I would say, from his Hong Kong family.
And you mentioned it before. Can you talk a little bit about his interests on the side?
Yeah. So this is one of sort of the revelations of the book. This had been kept quiet for many, many years and sort of kept out of Bruce's image. In the movie Dragon, the Bruce Lee movie, the Bruce Lee story, he was portrayed as a perfect father and family man. But his attitudes were very much shaped by the 1950s. His grandfather had 13 concubines. Most Americans don't realize is that in China, polygamy was very prevalent, particularly for wealthy men. And then, of course, he came to Hollywood in the 1960s, the swinging 60s, and Steve McQueen was his mentor. And there was a lot of, running around going on in Hollywood at that time, as there is today as well. And so Bruce came from a culture and then was part of a culture that didn't really particularly believe in monogamy. And he acted that way. He had some affairs that no one had known about until I talked to some of the women. So he loved his wife. He was dedicated to her, but he felt, what he did on his own time was his business.
And there also was some reluctancy to getting married in the first place.
Yes, that's something also that was sort of kept out of the record. Linda Lee wrote two books about her husband, and she sort of skipped over the fact that the marriage occurred because she was pregnant. And when he first found out, he initially was not sure what to do. And it took him a couple months before his friend Taki Kimura convinced him that Linda was really amazing and he wouldn't do better and he should marry her.
And so they would go on to have two children, and Brandon Lee, which you mentioned before, was reportedly accidentally shot with a prop gun that contained live ammunition during the filming of The Crow. What's your take on his son's death?
From all accounts, that's what happened. Basically, he was on a film set that was trying to make what they said was a $30 million movie for 12, which meant they cut corners and they hired a bunch of inexperienced people. And the prop master didn't check the barrel of the gun before the scene in which Brandon was shot and killed. And what had happened is that earlier a slug from a bullet had gotten stuck in the barrel. And after every scene, they're supposed to check, break down a gun and check that it's okay, that this doesn't happen. And they hadn't done that. And so for the scene, there was a slug stuck in the barrel and they put blanks in the chamber and the blank essentially turned it into a live gun. And the blank fired the slug in the barrel into Brandon's torso and killed him. And given that the father had died young and the son dies young and both under sort of weird circumstances, this created this, a thousand different conspiracy theories. But as far as I can tell from all the research, it was just a tragic accident.
And with Bruce's death, he passed away before completing what turned out to be his final movie, Game of Death. And during the filming of Enter the Dragon, he was diagnosed with cerebral edema.
Yep.
Can you talk about what happened on the day of his death?
Yes. So this is another great mystery. And one of the things that But the reason why it took 7 years to write the book is because it took a couple years to sort out what exactly happened on Bruce's last day. From the best of my knowledge and based on my reporting and research, Bruce spent the morning at the Golden Harvest Studios discussing Game of Death. And then he went to spend the afternoon with his mistress, Betty Ting Pei. And that day, July 20th, was the hottest of the summer. And he invited over Raymond Chow, who was his boss, to Betty's apartment, and he was performing a bunch of kung fu scenes from Game of Death, and he got overheated. Raymond Chow told me that he became dizzy and thirsty, and he complained of a headache, and he went to lie down, and he never got back up again. And then what happened afterwards was Raymond Chow realized if the press found out that Bruce had died in the apartment of an actress who wasn't his wife, it would cause a great scandal, because Hong Kong, despite everything, was still fairly conservative at the time. And so Raymond Chow decided to fudge where Bruce died and say that it happened at home with his wife. And when that was discovered as a cover-up, it created 1,000 different conspiracy theories. Many people to this day believe Bruce was killed.
And was he given drugs of some kind before he didn't wake up?
Yes. Yeah, so when he complained of a headache, he was given a prescription pain medication that has a bit of aspirin in it and also another substance that's basically a muscle relaxant. That was one of Betty's prescriptions. It's basically used for cramps. And so there are people who believe that he died from an allergic reaction to the aspirin contained in that medicine. He'd also had some hash during the day. So there's a whole nother group of people who think it was the hash that killed him. But we know scientifically that's impossible. And my theory, after researching this and talking to forensic experts, is that he died from heat stroke. He had collapsed 10 weeks earlier in a very hot room where they turned off the air conditioning. But more importantly, a few months before that, he had had an operation that removed the sweat glands from underneath his armpits, which would have made it more difficult for him to dissipate heat.
Why did the surgery occur?
Vanity, to be quick about it. You know, he was on screen every day filming with his shirt off, and it was frustrating because he would sweat immensely, and they'd have to wipe him down. And so he went to the doctor to complain about this. And apparently in the 1970s, this was a fairly frequent operation. They said, well, if you don't like sweating so much, we can remove the sweat glands under your armpits and then it won't be a problem. And so I don't think he thought of it. There was any danger to it. And he had the operation.
And after he passed away, there were several actors who imitated him in what's called Bruceploitation, from Bruce Lai to Bronson Lee. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So what's amazing about Bruce is he dies so early that he creates this almost superheroic image, and he becomes a kind of comic book character. So Bruce Lee is played as if you had different actors playing Superman or Batman. Bruce Lee is almost his own comic book character, and any actor can play him who kind of looks like him and can do the moves. And so in Hong Kong, they would cast what they called Lee-alikes, or Bruce Lee imitators, kind of like Elvis Presley imitators. And they would stick them in films, and the movies would be called like Enter the Dragon 2 or Return of the Dragon Who Enters Fists of Fury. They had all these weird names. And basically they were cons. They would send them over to the West and hope that Americans who didn't know very much about Bruce Lee would think that this was Bruce Lee in the movie and buy tickets to them. And so this was an entire genre. There's over 50 Bruceploitation movies that were made in the late 70s and early 80s.
And who is there to carry on his legacy? Who's carrying on the legacy of Bruce Lee today?
Well, I think the most obvious person is Jackie Chan. A lot of people don't know that Jackie Chan was a stunt guy on two of Bruce's movies. He appears very briefly in Enter the Dragon in the scene where Bruce grabs him by the mop of his hair and, you know, fake snaps his neck on screen. And so Bruce and Jackie were pretty good friends. Bruce was slightly older. And Jackie Chan is, in fact, one of the people they tried to turn into the next Bruce Lee. But all those movies failed because Jackie couldn't do what Bruce did. He had to find his own style. And so that's why Jackie became a comedic actor, because he realized Bruce was always tough, so he would be the person who made it funny and showed pain. And so Jackie Chan's really the heir to Bruce Lee's throne.
Why would you say that Bruce Lee is an icon in your estimation?
Well, there's a couple things that he did that are incredible. First is he's the first Chinese-American male actor to ever star in a Hollywood movie. So he's the Jackie Robinson of Asian actors. And the staggering odds he was up against were so amazing. And we know it's so amazing because so very few Asian actors have been able to repeat that. Aside from Jackie Chan and maybe Jet Li, no one else has been able to star in a Hollywood movie as a Chinese actor. And so Bruce Lee broke through the barrier at a time of incredible discrimination. The second amazing accomplishment was he wanted to use movies to spread Asian culture to the West and show them the beauty of what China had. And so his kung fu movies were really an advertisement for Chinese culture, and he succeeded beyond his wildest expectations. He really introduced more Westerners to Asian culture than any other person to ever live, and converted millions and millions of Westerners like me to become martial artists.
What do you think it's important for the world to know about Bruce Lee?
I think the important moral of Bruce's story is that the impossible is possible sometimes if you're willing to pay the price. And Bruce, through his ambition, talent, and just unwillingness to accept no, kept at something that anybody else would have quit. And because of that, he was able to achieve something that no one else had before him, and so very few people have since. And I think that's the inspirational lesson of Bruce Lee's life.
Well, Matthew Polly, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, that was great. Thank you.
That was journalist Matthew Polly, author of the new biography, Bruce Lee, A Life. He is also a fellow at Yale University and teaches a course on Bruce Lee. Up next, we have a tribute by Zoe Williams dedicated to the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, who died yesterday, August 16th, 2018, at the age of 76.
In all of music history, there's never been a voice like the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Born in Memphis, Tennessee in 1942, the daughter of pastor and civil rights activist C.L. Franklin, Aretha grew up singing in her father's Baptist church in Detroit. She learned piano by ear and toured with her father's gospel caravan as a teen. It was with Atlantic Records in 1967 that Aretha established herself as a musical force.
I love to sing. It's just a natural thing for me.
Her 56-year career has resulted in 20 number one R&B singles, third most Grammys in history for a female artist, induction into the Gospel and R&B Halls of Fame, and the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Just doing my thing. That's it. Just doing my thing.
The one and only Queen of Soul.
Speaking words of wisdom, let it be.
Aretha Franklin.
Let it be, let it be, let it be.
That was Zoe Williams and his tribute to the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, who died yesterday at the age of 76. And coming up on Saturday, August 25th, the New Parkway Theater continues its community partnership with KPFA with the classic yet timely movie about race relations in America, with the screening of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. So please come out and support KPFA's movie matinee on Saturday, August 25th at 3 p.m. For ticket information, go to thenewparkway.com. That does it for today's show. Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect with us on social media. If you'd like to give us feedback on something you heard or suggest something for us to cover, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Producers Corinne Smith, engineers Kirsten Thomas, interns are Justin Gold and Clara Sophia Daly. Hosts are Brian Edwards-Tickard, Antonia Yuhas, Gina Madrid, and me, Janine Etter. also Mitch Jezerich and Eileen Alfandari. Stay tuned for Rising Up with Sonali at 8.